Welcome to Midnight in the Marshaverse. I'm Marsha. This is the verse, and it's midnight. And welcome. We take this time every week to chill out, to take a moment, to have some fun. Late night, it's the end of the day, beginning of a new day. And so we just want to chill and relax and take time that we don't usually get in the day. And because I like to chill with cannabis and cognac, you're welcome to join me, or you're welcome to have a glass of water and a cookie. I don't really care. But I am having, cannabis this week is the cutest little thing. It's this little disposable called an Endo Puff. It's tiny. I saw it and I got it. It has Acapulco Gold vape juice in there. So I'm going to get into that. And the cognac today is a Martell VSOP, a very special old pale. And so we're going to pour a little something and get things started. Look. That's about all we need. We're not going to be greedy. Okay. So now that we have our cannabis and cognac, here's to you. Thank you, Paul. I always have to thank Paul Mooney for introducing me to cognac. This the shit that Massa wouldn't let us have. Now I'm going to take a hit, and you're welcome to join me. We can be on the same page. Those of us who indulge, let's get on that page. Those of us who don't, get on your high horse and feel superior. Here we go. All right. Now, let's get on with the show. And we start with my comediosophy. And my comediosophy to explain this week is there's a video going around on Instagram and other of my social media of me appearing on the Richard Pryor roast in 1977. And a lot of people seem not to know who I am. They know Night Court. They know some of the things I've done. But a lot of people don't know that I am a damn good stand-up comedian. I have been doing stand-up for years, and I learned from the best. I learned from my mentors and from the comedians I've been fortunate enough to work with, to be around, who took me under their wing and taught me so much. And so the Richard Pryor show, the Richard Pryor roast, I got to roast him and he laughed. And a lot of the young people are seeing me young for the first time. And one person wrote on, I can't remember which platform, wrote, Marsha Warfield couldn't have been a dyke back then because she was fine. And I wrote back, I'm like I can't be a fine ass dyke. I think I'm a fine-ass dyke now. So I could have been a fine-ass dyke then, but I didn't know I was, and it was a whole nother time. It was a different way of life. But anyway, so I'm roasting Richard as if I'm one of his disgruntled lovers. And they seem to think I did pretty well. But, you know, that's not the only time I think I look good on pictures and videos and stuff. I think we have some pictures we can see I would never somebody you kick out of bed. I kick back. But anyway, now that we have that understood. And so when you see me, like this week, I am going to be at the Comedy Cellar for two nights on Thursday and Friday, two shows each night. And so now that you see and know that I know what I'm doing when it comes to stand-up, come on out and see me if you're here in Vegas. And if I'm in your town, which the upcoming dates will be at the end, come out and see me. See for yourself. And you'll see. You'll be a convert. I was talking about when I started doing stand-up. And when I came back, I took time off, 20 years off. And when I came back, I had to learn how to do stand-up all over again. And it wasn't all that easy. You know, I had to go back to the open mics and the nightclubs and just teach myself how to do stand-up again. And so now I'm at the stage where I think I've got it down again. It's the most amazing experience to have, to be a rookie with experience. You know, like the second time around, I knew how much I didn't know because I had been through it before and I knew how much work I had to do. But to be a rookie with experience was weird. But what helped me get through all of it is the relationships I've been fortunate enough to form. And when I went on stage the first night, there was a core group of comedians who were working at that time who kind of took me under their wing and hit me to the game. And when I went to Los Angeles, again, I found another place in a brotherhood and was accepted by them. And so I've been mentored by the best. I met Richard Pryor not long after I got to Los Angeles. He was working out one of his albums at the Comedy Store. And to sit and talk to him, to sit and watch him, was more than enough for me, paid for my trip to Los Angeles 90 times over. But then to later on get to work on the show was just beyond everything. I learned so much, I experienced so much, and I still have a piece of tape or couple of pieces of video or digital, whatever it is, floating around, going viral almost 50 years later, because I had the opportunity to work with not only Richard, but some really, really talented people. And one of those people who fits both those categories, who was there the first night I went on stage, and who was there on the Richard Pryor show, and has had just his own wonderful career and is still going strong, is here with me tonight, and his name is Brad Sanders. And we'll get into the hijinks and the memories and the low drinks, whatever, back in the day. There's a lot of water under a 50-year-old bridge. And so, but we had the good fortune of growing up in a time of a real expansion and change and boom and just progress. That's probably more important than the jokes we got to tell and, you know, being on the road and going to new places and doing new things. So anyway, I look forward to talking to Brad, to introducing him to y'all. Y'all know him already, and you'll see. But I look forward to spending time with him and with you and drinking cognac. And hold on a minute. I don't don't see why I can't spend the rest of my life drinking cognac, smoking weed, and talking shit. I find that to be a goal. And so I'm going to work real hard at trying to make that life goal come true. Right now, is it time? Is it time for Aunt Karen? Right now we have I have to tell you about our sponsor, Aunt Karen. Dwight Company Global introduces Aunt Karen's all-American friend, Brer Clarence, the honeypot bear. Brer Clarence's sweet deal meals are on sale everywhere. You can bet your Aunt Karen that her inspired recipes will be suburban seasoning chef's kiss sweet with Brer Clarence's fingers in your pot. And Brer Clarence's extra stuffed seasoning packets ensure that all your casseroles in a can will be delightfully enriched with no telltale sticky residue on the bear or your hands. Just be careful. Brer Clarence's sweet deal sticky meals combined with Aunt Karen's suburban season boil-in-canned casseroles will be so good, your family might have to call the police on each other. Thank you, Aunt Karen and Brer Clarence, your sticky finger bear. We are so fortunate to have you as our sponsor. And now, drum roll, please. It's time. Yay. Everybody's take your seats. Yay. Okay. This next gentleman is a good friend of mine. And when he had been doing stand-up, I thought forever when I met him. And I was a rookie, knew nothing. And I took a bus, a train, another bus. I don't know. It took me forever to get from my house to the club where I met him. And so at 2:33 o'clock in the morning, I was going to have to take that trip back to the South Side. And they gave me a ride and started telling me about show business. And that started a friendship and a mentorship that lasts to this day. And I'd like to introduce you to my friend. You know him as from the Clarence Updates and It's Your World and so many other things. But now he's here and he'll tell you himself. Ladies and gentlemen, say hello to my friend Brad Sanders.
Hey, what's up, Mozella?
What's up with you? How you doing?
I'm doing great. So are you. So nice to see you and doing your sponsors and everything. I was Clarence. Yeah, Brer Clarence. Oh my goodness, Brer Clarence.
Brer Clarence, you know Aunt Karen, yeah. The suburban seasonings. Well, she has a special relationship with those Supreme food companies. Brer Clarence and the Honeypot Bear.
Yes, indeed. A sweet deal. On sticky meals.
On sticky meals. So, how you doing? Do you remember that night, the first night I met you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. At the Pickle Barrel, yeah.
Yeah.
Tom Jesus started, he had a night at the Pickle Barrel, and Marsha came down there. It was her first time on stage, and he went up there, and he really massaged the audience. This young lady coming on, this is the first time. And she's doing it, and give her a chance, and it's going to be wonderful, and she's wonderful, and everything. Marsha got up there and killed the people. She should have sent flowers.
Yeah, it was only four of y'all, but four of y'all who wasn't comedians, but
you had a natural skill, and your pace, and your confidence. Of course, it was abject fear. We know that. But the audience didn't.
But and I was cool.
I was cool.
Okay.
Yeah. Just the way your deportment on the stage was like mega for somebody. First time out, please get out of here. But being a good writer, of course, that you had, how old were you when you had an article in Reader's Digest?
When I was a kid, they had those little art competitions, and but then I think it got posted in Reader's Digest. That must have been in second, third grade. It was Gwendolyn Brooks.
Second, third grade, you in Reader's Digest? You know that wasn't for colored. You know.
Well, I didn't let it go.
You didn't
to my
know that, which is why.
I moved on in spite of that.
Oh yes, God.
But no, I had no idea what I was doing that night. I had no idea, nothing. I just went on instinct, and mm-hmm. I talk about it in my one woman show how at that moment a light shone down, and I knew that I had been called to this. And wow. I realized recently that I never looked back from that. I never mm-hmm. doubted. I never thought twice about, oh, there might be something else, or I might have made a mistake. Oh, it no. just never crossed my mind. I was amazed.
Well, you know, the unsung heroine in this whole thing is Evelyn Ivory. This woman... badgered, Marsha told me this. I didn't know this
yes.
up front, but this woman badgered Marsha to such an extent that she just snatched her up and brought her down to the club.
Evelyn and I went to high school together, and after high school, we still hung out. And when the article came out about Tom Dreesen having a open mic, nobody had heard of anything like that. I'd never heard of that. In Chicago in 1972, I mean, whatever. Nobody.
It was not. No, I didn't.
So, it was intriguing. And I told her I was going to go down there because they said anybody could try out if you came down and signed up. So I told her I was going to try that. And she said, okay. And then I never went. And so one day she showed up at my house and said, put your clothes on. We're going down there. I said, look, we're going down where? She said, I'm tired of you talking about going down here to this club, you going today. So we got dressed, got in the car, went down there, got there way too early, sat through who knows what. And I must have been about 2 o'clock in the morning when I went on.
Were there that many comics there?
Well, I know Judy Tenuta was there.
Judy.
And
man.
I know you and Daryl and wasn't Mr. B and James Wesley and Paul Kelly and
oh yeah, okay.
It was a lot of people, Brent.
Was Brent there yet?
I think so. Brent was there early on.
All right.
I think I met Bill, Dr. Bill later. But yeah, there were a lot of people. And didn't we go out and all go in a group and have breakfast or something? Anyway, you took me home.
Remember that night, me, you, and James Wesley Jackson went into a recording studio tripping on acid and recorded this not hilarious album.
This is supposed to be how mentorship helps you grow and develop, and you take it to how old dudes give young girls drugs.
You had your own. Don't play with me.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, we did that. And
but it was.
I hope there's no extant recording floating around.
Well,
that might come to haunt us.
I hope not. I hope it never comes out, but I have it somewhere.
Oh goodness.
No, darling, you don't want to hear that. Nobody wants to hear that.
Okay, but now, yeah, we don't want to hear that. We do want to hear about Mohambo and Sambo.
I know you're going to pull some stories out of me, boy. Everything reminds, when you get my age, everything reminds you of a story. I tell you that. Right?
Reminiscing is what we do.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Mohambo and Sambo, we were Bohannon and Sanders. And when you go down to these clubs, especially with, this was before the age of comedy clubs and open mics and all of that. We would just go to a club and just get on stage to see if we could get on. Well, we comedians and do. And we tell the guy to get in, the MC. It was always, you know, he mad because he the house MC and you taking up his time. So he player hating. And he said, oh, yeah, ladies and gentlemen, these two cats going to come to the stage. He said, buddy, I don't know. Welcome to the stage. What's your name? Bohannon and Sanders. Mahambo and Sambo. And so there we were.
Yeah. And I still fondly remember that. Remember when Jay Leno did the joke about being introduced as Ray Pino? So it happens.
Pino, by Ray Playboy Pino. Bunny. But yeah, he was, it's my name is Jay Leno. Jay Leno, right? Jay Leno, right? Yeah, Jay Leno. Achilles and gentlemen, welcome to the stage, Ray Pino.
Yay!
Well, show us your Pino, best.
Yep, so we get to Los Angeles. How long did you work in Chicago? And when did you first meet Tom Dreesen? You mentioned he had the Pickle Barrel.
I did stand up in Chicago about 7 years before I went to LA. And Tom Dreesen had also a club on Monday night, Le Pub, which was a very nice little club in a hotel. And, you know, he would go in there. He had that Italian gift of gab. And he would go in there and say, wait, we can come in here on Sunday night. Give me your dark night. Give me your dark night. And that's how he started. Because he had gone out to L.A. and probably New York as well. But the Comedy Store was there. He had seen something out there where you can have these nights. And he got the idea to get a dark night where they didn't make any money anyway and just give me the room. And he had Irv Cupson in from the Sun Times down there. He had writers down there. And he had different comics came in. Like Rip Taylor, Freddie Prinze came in, and you know, Tom was a good hustler. He was a hustler.
But you and Tom were both in comedy team.
Yeah, and we met at Joliet Penitentiary.
Okay, were you visiting or?
Well, yeah. Tom always says that. Brad and I met at Joliet State Penitentiary, and then what we were doing. Tim and Tom were doing a show on, and Phil Coran was a local jazz musician. He had a band and everything. And I think he even had, he had one of the more famous saxophone players with him. And he took the show out to Joliet and he took us with him. So we performed to a captive audience. It was very interesting. It was a very interesting time. Yeah, that's where Tom and I met.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we all ended up chasing the Tonight Show and the Comedy Store west. And we all left Chicago relatively soon after that, because I started in 1974 and I left in 1976. So Tom was already in Los Angeles and you came not long after.
Yeah, I came also in 1976 to Los Angeles.
Okay, but I got there in March.
Yeah, because you tricked your family into giving you a birthday present to Los Angeles. She went to LA, y'all, and never went back.
No, because I told them I was going to hitchhike. I was remembering they used to have, you used to be able to hitchhike around across country, and they had those drive-away things where you could
drive
somebody's car.
Man, ain't nowhere in the world I have my black ass out there hitchhiking.
I was going to do the hippie going to the hate pilgrimage, and I threatened everybody within earshot that's what I was going to do.
That was slick.
And I can do what I want to, and I'm going to Los Angeles.
Oh, man, we're going to buy you a ticket, okay? For your birthday. Okay. We're just going to buy you a ticket because you're talking crazy.
If you wait, I'll give you a ticket to Los Angeles for your birthday. Well, I can't do nothing with no ticket. I'll give you 2 weeks. You figure it out. You see what's going on, and you'll have a return ticket if you want to come home. I said, okay, great. And I got to Los Angeles on my birthday, on the Friday, I believe it was. I could see the Comedy Store right next door. I went there as soon as I could. And I, Monday, I cashed in my ticket.
I was going to ask you.
I got a job in Beverly Hills, and I auditioned at the Comedy Store with same night, Argus Hamilton.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that passed over. Yeah, but I didn't care.
You were for National Service, didn't you?
Yes, because I was a switchboard operator in Chicago. I worked for the Bell System with my mother and had been that long distance operator voice on the other end in the beginning of my shift. By the end of my shift, it was long distance operator. And it was a whole different job. But so we get to Los Angeles. Remember, every time we got a ride home, the only people with cars were like white guys with Volkswagens.
Joey Gaynor. So
every time we would get a ride home, we'd get pulled over on La Cienega Doheny at that corner.
Yeah, because we were coming from Beverly Hills. And if a black person was in Beverly Hills at, you know, after 11 o'clock, an alarm went off. So the police came out. Joey Gaynor was giving us a ride home. We were coming from the E Little Club with a marshal or something with the guy's name. Anyway, we were coming from the club. We get pulled over. We're coming down Santa Monica Boulevard. We get pulled over. And the cop is talking. He's got his hand on his pistol, and he's talking, and he goes to Joey, "Are you all right?" Like, we done kidnapped him.
That's what they always ask the white driver.
Are you all right? Okay? You okay?
How do you know this guy? That's what they ask us. How do you know this driver?
I said, yeah, this is Joey Gaynor. He's a comedian. We're friends. We're a comedian. Yeah. And Marsha telling the police, "Would you please take your hand off your gun? Please." And with a big old smile on his face. And he did.
Yes.
The popo took his hand off his gun because she said,
He was scaring me.
Getting all dainty and shit.
Yeah, well, it worked. Anyway.
It did, and I was glad. Let me just say that.
So after we get there and we got the comedy, the Richard Pryor show. What were you doing up until the time you got on the Pryor show?
Oh, man. What was I doing?
You're still playing golf. Let's go there.
I was a caddy at the L.A. Country Club, and I had never caddied before in my life. But I was trying to play golf. I like golf. I was a caddy at the L.A. Country Club, and that is like being a gun bearer in a Target, as in Tarzan movie. Is she brick to the left, Buona? Yes, Buona. Hear your pitching wave, Buona. You know, it was steam range. And they put you in a caddy yard. And it was like an antebellum building structure was the main house. And you couldn't go up on that level without permission. And the caddies were down in the caddy yard below. And the caddy master, which is actually what his position was called, Al Hindi, came over and looked over the rail and go, "Come on, Jorge. Come on, Jesus. Come on, Gonzalez." Then he walk away and look back over his shoulder and go, "Come on, Brad." I'm like, okay. Screw you too, but here I come.
So, but that was how, was that just for the exercise, for the extra cash, or for the contacts?
The contacts? Baby, they didn't have no blacks, no Jews, no entertainers, and no dogs at the LA Country Club. Okay. So no, I wasn't gonna make no contact. I met some I caddied for Robert Clark, I think it was. He was the chairman of the board of Standard Oil. I caddy for some of them. I wasn't going to be no contacting. Get your black ass back on the bus and go on, you know, down there on Tamarind. So I also got Bill Miller got me a job doing phone sales.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and we were selling we were selling ad space in these rag newspapers.
Okay.
So we look in the paper and find the company that was looking for mechanics or whatever it may be, and call them up to sell them ad space in these rag papers that we had. So, you know, like we had the Intermountain Jewish News, the Reichstatten, you know, yeah, that was one of them. And Bill Miller.
Really scary.
Oh, it was nuts. Bill Miller would call up these people. Okay, you're looking for a mechanic. He goes, how, or some, oh, there was an Asian one. And he called him up and he put a pencil in his mouth like this. Hello, this is Castle Manishi Times. Yeah, I called you from the Castle Manishi. I said, oh, that is so wrong. So many, even back then.
That's very wrong. Mickey Rooney and Breakfast at Tiffany kind of stuff.
This was terrible. I was bad at it. But the guy paid a weekly wage at commission, plus commission. But I didn't make a commission. So I said, look, man, I'm wasting your time and mine. Let me just go and get that $105 and bounce. And the guy said, yeah, you're right, man. Here. Mitchell Walters had this guy. He could never sell him anything. He would always call this guy. He was a priest. And he would call this guy, and father, listen, father. We got 25 computers. We got 25 computers, father. We want to give them to the church. We want to give them to you. And the father, no, I don't want anything. Thank you very much. No, father. These are free computers. These are great computers. They're brand new. They're in the box. They're sealed. They're computers. They're great, father. You got to get, I don't want the computers. Come on, father. So he wore him down. He said, all right, send them over. Okay, the computers are free, but you got to buy the fucking truck.
Oh, okay. After this, then we do the Richard Pryor show and we were there the day he got married.
Oh, my God, yeah.
You remember, you were there, right?
Yeah, I was there, and Pam Grier clowned. Yeah.
Well, see, we didn't see that. Huh? We didn't see that.
I saw the bandage on her hand.
He showed up with a carnation and a salmon-colored suit and a tie, peach. And I'm like, he just got married. Everybody told me I was crazy. And sure enough, he had just gotten married and messed up my rehearsal.
Yeah, he was, because they got married on the soundstage. They put parquet tile on the floor in the rehearsal hall, wasn't the soundstage. Met in the rehearsal hall, and that's where they got married at. And I was in the Jet.
You was in the what?
In the Jet magazine.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, don't get brand new. The Jet. You know the Jet.
What was you doing in the Jet?
Standing at the wedding. I was at the wedding. I had on my one cool outfit. My mother had given me that fabric, Kiana fabric that's supposed to be silk.
Okay.
It looked like silk, and an Amway gold necklace and some jeans. And I bought myself some of them Kmart track shoes. And I was standing there in that, and you could see me in the crowd just trying to throw my face to the camera. Yeah.
Now, I remember you in the Inherit the Wind sketch.
What was that?
Inherit the Wind, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, yeah. My baby, that was you. My baby. My baby. Yeah.
And Tim Reed feeling your head.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, like he was. Oh yeah, he come up there. He said, "Yeah." He said, "No, this." He was, because he was trying to find the white section or the black section, and he was blind, so he had the
wrong section.
He was the wrong section. You know, no.
And you gotta move.
Okay. I'm home now. He felt my burr head.
You always were a soap opera fan. And the soap operas hit a boom in the late 70s, early 80s. Well, in the 70s, 80s, they just hit a boom. Everywhere. And you were a part of that.
Yeah, but that was after I had gotten on like Merv Griffin, Dinah Shore, and Comedy Shop with Norm Crosby. But leading up to that, I was giving you my scrub jobs before I even started getting any of that, you know, going to just trying to hustle up on some money. The soap opera, I got hooked on soap operas in Chicago with my mother, her stories. But I got hooked on All My Children playing golf with Seth McCormick. And he had to leave so he could go home and watch All My Children. And I'm like, what? Yeah, I got to see Miss Kane, man. Miss Kane. And so I went, you know, so I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. And so I started watching and I got hooked on it. And the reason I started doing a soap up, I started doing it on my stand up, talking about the soaps on stage. It was a nice bit. It was a hook. And so, but the thing I learned in third grade enabled me to really make use of that. The teacher, Miss Carruthers, would have you read a story and tell it back in your own words. And so that's what Clance, C-L-A-E-N-C-E, not Clarence, Clance.
Clance.
Yeah, that's what he was doing. I combined that with a character I saw at the Winchester Bar named Clance. Yeah, my name Clance, baby, give me a drink. And, you know, so I put those two elements together to come with the character. And I would talk about the soaps on stage. And I would see people, you know, I see ladies nudging their boyfriend, and I'm, you know, and they're quiet, they ain't laughing. So I'm saying, okay, this is dying. And come to find out, they were so intent because they was all hooked on the soaps,
right?
And man, you know, when I got done, they was like, yeah.
Well, yeah, a man having an interest in soap operas at that time was not really all that normal. That was women stuff, and it looked at with disdain. So for you to validate all those women,
and I knew
the charming story. Ass, you know, and that charm has led you to your Be Good to Women.
Oh yeah, Be Good to Women Day. Yeah, I love women. Period. I was in Dallas at a comedy club in Dallas. And I was doing that on stage. Tom Joyner was in the audience. And he invited me to his show and asked me to do that bit. He was doing a soap opera thing, Down and Dirty, Funky, Nasty, All My Children Update on the radio. Hey. He said, I saw you do your thing. I want you to do it on the mic. And I did it and the phones went crazy. I overheard people talking about it. And that's when I got the idea. Coco Evans was doing comedy on KJLH, and she was a brilliant mimic, and she did all these voices and stuff. And I said, they don't know what to do with her. I'm gonna go down there and work with her. I took a bunch of stuff down there. And one of the bits that I had in my stack of material was the soap opera thing. And Jim Maddox, the general manager, said, I'm gonna put that on. And that's how I became a radio piece. But the best thing that they ever did for me at KJLH was not pay me. So I started hustling around other stations. One thing led to another. And I ended up with New York, Chicago, LA, Philly. I had 10 of the top 10 stations in the country. And I had tried to get on. I didn't have LA. Jerry DeFrancisco caught up with me some kind of way while I was on the road doing a gig. And said, when can you start over here? And then that led to a syndication deal. That was my first syndication deal.
And then you ended up on CBS.
Yeah. So that was, you want to tell me, well, that was because of the lawsuit. All My Children sued me, even after giving me permission to do the show. And CBS said, like, free publicity? Sure. Come on. And so that led me to a relationship with CBS, which has been wonderful. And they had me doing But the good thing was Susan Banks. Susan Banks and her crew, she was the head of on-air promos. And she had all these great ideas. And she put Clarence in the, they had Jack Forrestal built a whole Soap Central set. And she had me in limos with four TV monitors. So I could see all four of the CBS soaps and talk about the best wardrobe and a mystery lady. I was writing for this magazine and all you ever saw was a hat brim and a glove.
Go ahead, brag. Anyway,
I'm talking about being blessed, baby. That's what I'm talking about.
That's wonderful, and yes, blessed, all that kind of stuff. But when the blessings was being handed out, they were being handed out specifically to you. So it wasn't like you got somebody else's blessings. Anyway,
I ain't even going there with you.
But I see you as bragging righteously, and you should be braggadocious about your accomplishments.
I'm appreciative about my accomplishment. That's no argument there. Yeah, I did it. You have to go and do something. I didn't say somebody just dropped it in my lap. By the same token, if God hadn't given me that blessing, if I had thought of it all by myself, I would have thought of it long before I was looking on the Comedy Store floor for money. If it was just me. So that's where I'm at with that. I didn't come on here to proselytize.
Everybody got a thing, and your thing is valid for you. It works for you. I ain't got no problem with it.
That's all.
I'm just saying that from my point of view, a lot of times people, like all of us, we hide your light under a bushel so that you don't take the credit and place it elsewhere. Not just you, but knowing what it takes and what it does, and nobody asked us to do this. Nobody told us how to do this. There's no blueprint, no nothing. And you did the things you've done because you are who you are. And you did that. And so because you did that and you made that work for you, I say bravo and congratulations.
Well, thank you.
For what you've done.
Well,
and I want you to get your flowers, while I'm here to give them to you.
Well, I'll tell you, I loved the fact that you said on the Breakfast Club with Charlemagne the God, he said, who helped you? You say everybody. And then you gave me mad love. So don't think I don't appreciate it.
You was there. But let's bring on my sons, my two sons. My oldest son.
Yes.
I'm going to, just we've been working together. We started working together. I met him when he was working with Rain Pryor. And they did a show, and then we ended up working together at the Strat, at the LA Comedy Club. And he's a very funny man, and he also is the producer of my one-woman show, The Book of Marcia. So please say hello to my son, Stephen Roberts.
And don't say Steve, it's Stephen. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, thank you for saying Stephen.
Okay.
Oh, you're welcome.
My youngest son, my baby boy, my problem child, I love him dearly. He and I started working together at the LA Comedy Club back in the day, and worked all the way up until COVID. And now he's just working all over the country. He's opening for Lunell at Jimmy Kimmel's and has his own night, Friday night, Show Those Skills show at Jimmy Kimmel's, and he is here with us tonight. Say hello to my baby boy, Skills Hudson.
Hey, Skills Hudson. What's up?
Hey, y'all.
Hey.
What's
so,
up?
Gentlemen.
Everything's good, bro.
Skills is from Chicago.
Oh, okay, homie.
So you've been listening. You have anything to ask an old comedian?
Well, I just wanted to say that a few years ago, Marcia sent Skills and I over to see Tom Dreesen do his one-man show about all his adventures with Frank Sinatra. Mm-hmm. And she arranged for us to meet Tom. And turns out Skills and Tom grew up in the same neighborhood.
Oh, Harvey. And,
yeah. Yep. And so they were talking. I mean, they just started to go back to the old days and yeah. about start comparing their neighborhoods. It was really cool. And I lived in Chicago for about 5 years.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. I had a reference point for it. It was pretty great to hear those two talk about it and see them connect like that. That was a real great memory, wasn't it, Skills?
Yeah, it was a real black and white moment.
Yeah. Kodak.
Well, Tom, for those who aren't aware, has a history of black and white moments, you know, being in a racial comedy team. And we had, you know, there's the Comedy Store mainstream circuit comic where comics try to work. And then black comics have a Chitlin circuit that we work. And so we'd be working these clubs on the far south side, these bars, these places where they turn the jukebox on if you're not funny, or they cut off the bank. They just all kind of stuff. You know, just like we would go to the north side to go to those clubs, we'd invite the comics from the north side to come to the south side. Most of them wouldn't come. Tom always came. Tom owned the room. Tom never had any fear or of the room he was in because the audience wasn't white. He came and did his set, and some other comics who came with him. There was one. I ain't gonna name him. There was one, and he was waiting to go on, and we're sitting in the back, and everybody's just talking in the little booth, and all of a sudden we look over, and this guy is going. And he couldn't stop hyperventilating. It was just sheer terror. That he was always just Tom, and we all, mm-hmm. Bill Miller was like that. Never tried to be anything they weren't. You know, they were mm-hmm. still
white guys.
Still white guy accents and still doing their thing. And I always appreciated that they didn't have that deer in the headlights reaction to just being around a different crowd.
You know, the ones that used to get me was the white guys trying to black up. You know, I'm standing. I was one of the things I did when I first moved to L.A. was hand out roses at an Olivia Newton-John concert at the Greek Theater. A rose, compliments of Olivia. A rose, compliments of Olivia. Compliments of Olivia. And this white guy comes there with, "Hey, brother, look here, man. Can I get a lot? Can I get a flower for my lady? Is that cool?" White dude. And so I said, "Oh my God. Oh, please don't hurt me."
You were in Hollywood Shuffle.
Yeah.
And we came up in an era of, can you do it a little blacker?
Oh.
You know, and you'd be in a reading, and that was nice, but you know, we're looking for some, could you give us a little more of that thing, that urban thing, you know, you guys do? And we, as just one mind, all would just look at them and go, "I don't understand what you mean."
You don't know what you mean. I know what you're talking about.
They would show us. And so they're all of a sudden, "Come on, you know what I mean. You know, how you like that, you know, like that."
I didn't get that treatment. They were really wanting to, they were really working you.
No, can you do it a little blacker? But yeah. Not like, you know, a little more urban, a little more, you know, that thing you guys do.
You guys, don't you love that?
Yeah.
That thing you guys do.
Being that you said that you had did 7 years in Chicago, kind of before you moved out to the West, where did you come from before then? And secondly, when you did one of my favorite movies, Brewster's Million,
yeah,
how was that audition process?
Oh, that was gangster. That was cool. Okay, first First question, what I did in Chicago before I went to LA, what clubs?
No. Where did you, before you got to Chicago, before you went to LA?
Before I got to Chicago.
You said you did 7 years in Chicago before. Right. So was it something before Chicago or were you just saying?
No, I was born in Chicago.
Oh, okay. Okay.
At Cook County Hospital.
Oh, yeah. Me too. I'm
talking
about Cook County Hospital.
Yeah, Cook County, bro. No, I'm talking like before Chicago. Hell, it wasn't no.
Okay, yeah.
So the other part of your question was Brewster's Millions audition.
Yes.
I auditioned for that part with against George Wallace and Arsenio Hall.
Wow.
And what happened was, I was open for Eddie Harris at Marla's Memory Lane, and Richard came down there, and I didn't think nothing of it. I didn't connect. I'm opening for Eddie Harris. Richard just wanted to come out and have a drink, and just a side note, the hardest thing about being a star is you can't just observe people like you used to before you became a comedian. Because now they switch up on you. They want your picture, they want your autograph, they don't talk the same to each other while they're in your presence. So anyway, by the time I finished my set opening up, the room was, all on Richard. So he finished his drink. He sent me a drink over and he finished his drink, and that was it. He walked out. And then I got the call from Norman Elijah. Called me. He says, they want to see you for this movie. I said, well, shoot, I'm getting ready to go on the road, but, on the road. I was going to a club, but the club was out of town, so he tried to glamorize it. Anyway, so he said, don't worry about it. Go do your gig. They won't make a movie until you get back. I'm like, okay. So Norman Elijah shepherded that deal. That's how I got in it. And that suit that you see me wearing in Brewster's Millions was the same suit that Eddie Murphy wore in 48 Hours. And wow. I told him, I'm going to have to change this crotch out of these pants. You're going to have to tighten that. Y'all going to have to, I ain't trying to be no diva. I ain't got no rider, all green M&Ms and bullshit like that. I'm glad to be here, but I'm not going to catch nothing.
It seems like a comedy team. I hear that a lot, especially with Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen. And Marcia had mentioned very briefly that you were on a comedy team. So yeah. Is comedy team two people for you or three, or what was that all about?
It was two people. It's me. It's just, we had a very unique comedy team, two straight guys. And I don't mean sexually. Well, we were that, but I don't know about Daryl. But anyway.
Mohambo.
But I say we had a unique comedy team, two straight guys, and the audience be like, "Well, look, I ain't no comedy expert, but I know one of y'all supposed to be funny. One of y'all supposed to be the straight man. The other one is the joke man. Y'all two straight men."
What was that all about? Was that just like you basically having a conversation on stage?
No. I'm just saying that because that didn't really happen.
Okay.
But we were just Rusty and Bauman and whatever.
Bohannon and Sanders were on stage at the 3G's, which was on 113th and Halston.
103rd.
100 something and Halston.
103rd. That's where Kelly Monteith was at with Tom Dreesen looking all hyperventilating. That's where that happened. At.
Yes, that's where, and that's where Orlando got shot in the face.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of club we're in. These guys are on stage and they do a bit about a game show.
It's up the creek without a paddle.
And they needed a contestant. So there's not a whole lot of people there. Some people at the bar, they got on like bus driver uniforms and stuff, and they deep into their shots, And there's two guys in long leather coats sitting up front like this. And so Brad and Daryl decide they would be the perfect contestants for Up the Creek Without a Paddle. And they're going like, no, we can't. And come on down, be up the creek. With a, come on. And, he's come on. And then finally one dude said, all right. And he turns to his partner. He said, okay. And he stands up and reaches into this coat and pulls out the longest pistol you've ever seen. And hands it to his friend. And then goes on stage.
Oh my God.
And I said, that's the power of stand-up. You can disarm gang members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because everybody needs to laugh.
And he did the bit. They had fun.
He was glad to be there.
He had disarmed. They had disarmed an audience just with their stand-up. So that was the learning, a significant moment for me.
Marsha had you as a mentor. Did you have a mentor?
Well, actually, whenever there was a comedian in town, I went to see him and tried to meet him. I went to see Dick Gregory.
Wow.
He was working at a club at the Robert's 500 room. And that's, you know, when it was new. And I approached him and he said, man, let's be cool. Anyway, he invited me back to his room. He was sitting on the toilet. I was sitting on the tub. And he gave me a lot of pointers about comedy. He said, read joke books, read comic books, read everybody, study Red Skelton, study all the comedians. That got me on the path of, you know, of being a comedy student. I went to the Niles Theater because Bill Cosby was there. I was working in Evanston. I got off early. He said, you're not going to. I said, I want to go meet Bill Cosby. You're not going to be able to get in there. So I show up and I go into this room. I thought it was a lounge. It had couches and a bar and this and that. And I didn't find out later I was sitting in Bill Cosby's dressing room. But anyway.
How did you get back there?
Well, you get there. That's the reason I had to get off work early, Stephen, so I could get in there and walk in with the band. You know, I walked in with people looked like they supposed to be there. Well, they weren't supposed to be there. But I walked in there with them and I went on and sat down somewhere. And then and people were cordial. This one white guy came up, can we get you anything? And we and then his son, well, this is my son, and blah, blah, blah. I said, oh, thank you. Nice to meet you. Yeah, I said, I know these people didn't think I'm no damn Bill Cosby. This is some bullshit. Yes, that was it, though. But that's why. So that gave me a little staying power. And when I found out that was Bill Cosby's dressing room, I went on out. And I talked to one of the security guards. The security guard, I told him I wanted to, you know, I wanted to do stand-up. And I want to meet Bill Cosby. And, you know, get some advice about stand-up and this and that. And we were talking. We got to talking. He says, okay, now, when Cosby comes through that door, same when I came in with the band, he said, when he comes through that door, don't approach him. Let me talk to him. So he's over there. He said, well, this young man wants to do this. I mean, the guy really went to bat for me. White dude. Really, you know, he like, yeah, he's a nice guy. He's a nice kid. But, you know, he just wanted to talk to you for a minute. Cosby talked to me in his dressing room. That's when I found out it was his dressing room. Was he took me in there, and he talked to me for about 48 minutes.
Wow.
He said, and I said, well, I want to work clean like you. He said, well, look, where you are, you got to work what the room requires. You're working, because he's from Philly. So he know I'm from Chicago. He said, you competing with, she's over here turning the trick over here. This dude just slinging some dope. This over here, you got to first get their attention. And you got to do what you need to do to get their attention. But once you get their attention, you got to pay them off. You got to be funny. You got to pay them off. Have something for them. That was a pointer. Dick Gregory, going back to him, that's when I started, because I got books that I got from Chicago. I got from Chicago Library right now. The Enjoyment of Laughter, the Psychology of Humor, The Enjoyment of Laughter, and Nobody. the book about biography of Burt Williams. I would study those things. Like I said, I went with Godfrey Cambridge came in town. I went to see him. Scoy Mitchell, Stu Gillum. I even went to see
George Kirby.
I got to meet George Kirby at something that Robert Townsend was doing. That was my mentorship. And then the other comedians, I can say the same thing. Who helped you? Everybody. Because when right. you're in the club with other comedians and you're kicking the game around, you pick up, you ain't there to ear hustle no material, but you watch them and how they set up this joke and how they segue to that thing over here. And all. So you get you get technique. Like I used to admire Alex Thomas, Chris Spencer, and Buddy Lewis. After the show, they would sit down and brush each other's act up. You should go here with that and do this, you know, that kind of thing. So mentorships, yeah, I had several. Sexism, because you're coming from a patriarchal society, and it's the same way in the United States of America. It's the same way all over the world. It's a patriarchy. The men have the power. So I'd say sexism, definitely.
Dang, I was going right with racism, but then at the end, what you said, Brad, I'm like, oh, okay, that is.
Yeah, the women sexism. Been a long time. Yeah. From the Bible, from wherever.
I'm right on, I'm sexism.
Okay.
For sure. I don't know which one came first after that, racism or homophobia.
I'm sure that homophobia was late to the party.
There's a lot of homosexual activity jumping off.
There, you know, if we even go back to Greece, there was no real proscription against homosexuality. That shows up, seems to be really late. But it's interesting that you said sexism right off the bat, because most, and here again, we're generalizing, most of the responses that I've seen, most black men immediately said racism, and then everything follows behind. I'm a big African-American History Museum buff. I love them. And last time I went to Chicago, I hooked up with some of my favorite TikTok creators. And they took me around. They took me to the South Side. They took me to some upper ghetto restaurants, and they gave me Pookie Bear gave me all the Jay's potato chips and Evan's potato chips you could ever want. I got t-shirts, and these three gentlemen, one Pookie Bear, he's the shooter, but when I met him, he was online, he was Pookie Bear. And then after his after his mom passed, you know, he wanted to change up. But his content, he's a dad, and his content is very questioning. And he's the kind of guy who would, if we had asked him that question, he would have said sexist right off the top. He's just, that's how he thinks. And so I wanted to meet him, and I wanted to meet a young man named Darnell Wright. He's deconstructing from his faith. We grew up in the church. And then when he went to college, he started questioning, and he did his dissertation on deconstructing and hip hop. And he thinks outside the box, and it's not whether you agree or disagree, just the brilliant mind of this young man is very stimulating. And I really wanted to meet him, and I did. And this last guy was he. During COVID, he started making TikToks about Chicago and about how dope Chicago is and how everything in Chicago is dope. And he started doing these little history minutes. And it got so popular that the city and different organizations started to call him like Chicago's unofficial historian. And he parlayed that love into a career, and he ended up starting a tour company. And we went on that tour when we were in Chicago. We went, it goes through Brownsville and historic black communities. And and one of the stops was the DuSable Museum, which I went to for the first time when it was at like one room, you know, one or two rooms in a house. And that was in the early 70s or late 60s. And I went then and I got to go again. And it is the Black History Museum that started the Black History Museum. And so the Wright Museum, which we went to in Detroit, and others, until the huge and wonderful National Museum of African American History and Culture, and all the ones in between, say that they got their inspiration from the DuSable Museum.
Really?
So anytime that we can visit those institutions, that we can donate if we can, that we can support, I think there's a group, you know, that needs to network so that we can all preserve those resources against the attacks that we're getting from right wing who want to shut down all knowledge of that history.
And yes. So I'm glad you're saying this. This is, you know, I'm gonna make sure I'm gonna send them my $2.
All right, send them last $2. We're not gonna lose them last $2. Thank you for a wonderful show. Thank you for spending time with me here in the Marshaverse. I can't wait to do this again. And thank you for tuning in. Be sure to like, comment, subscribe, all the good stuff. Tell your friends, give us suggestions, be nice, but tell us what you think. And come back and visit us again. We're on all over social media, Marshall Warfield dot whatever. And we'll be back next week and talk to some more people about some more interesting
stuff. Thank you so much for the invitation. It brings back so many good memories. It gives me a chance to remind myself of what I've been through. You know what I mean?
And we didn't even talk about Jimmy Cook.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So, ladies and gentlemen, there are more stories. And Brad, thank you. Love you. My two sons.
Thank you, Stephen.
All right, Brad.
Appreciate you.
Stephen.
In the booth running everything, Early and Gray, our producer. Thank you. And we'll see you next week. Come back.
All right. Peace.
Don't you know that the